It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll talk to Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about budget negotiations and some talk about a government shutdown. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
First, a look at life on the Great Lakes. Starting tomorrow, sailing enthusiasts will gather in Green Bay for the Tall Ships Festival. WPR's Aubrey Ruff spent the day on Wisconsin's official flagship, the schooner Dennis Sullivan, to relive the age of sailing on the Great Lakes.
I grew up on a small island off the northeast coast of Florida that since 1562 was ruled by 8 different nations. In a place so connected to the sea, I always had a longing for the adventure of life on one of those great, tall ships. Well, it turns out that those ships and that way of life are not lost to history. To get a taste of the experience, I spent a day on Wisconsin's official flagship, the Dennis Sullivan. She's a recreation of a typical 19th century Great Lakes schooner, 137 feet long with masts stretching 95 feet into the air. During the summer and fall, she represents Wisconsin and the age of sail at tall ship festivals all around the Great Lakes. Her home, though, is a pier behind Discovery World in Milwaukee. The ship has a professional crew of 10 who live full-time on board, plus her captain, Tiffany Crewan, but there are bunks for 21 additional paying students or volunteers. Today will be a short educational sail with a class of high school kids along for the ride. Before we get underway, Christian, my guide for the day, shows me around.
Now this is our galley. This is where our cook, Rod, makes our wonderful meals. We have a propane stove and oven there. Sinks. This is the only compartment with actual sitting. The compartment where the crew sleeps does not have any room except for the bunks, basically. Yeah. The reason you see daylight here is because we have so-called deck prisms that conduct the sunlight down below. When there is no light outside, then it's significantly darker in here.
Living conditions are tight, with the main crew all sleeping together in one small compartment. As we head down, I'm warned about the smell.
Maybe the main hold and maybe skip going into the forecastle. It kind of smells bad down there.
Yeah. Well, that's very authentic, though. You can see it's a fairly small compartment. It sleeps 10 people.
Wow.
And that is also why you have this weird olfactory sensation. It's a thing. If you cannot handle that, if you have to have a little alone time in the morning, then you're probably not going to be a good tall ship sailor.
When my tour's finished, it's time to cast off. And after clearing the harbor, the kids, under supervision, get to work hoisting the sails.
Heave! Ho!
Come on now!
Heave! Ho!
Watching 3,300 square feet of sail fill the sky takes my breath away. After all too short a time, we're pulling back into port. I'm sad the trip is over, but it really gets me thinking. I don't know what you'll be doing this summer, but I'm pretty sure I'll be getting a tan and having the adventure I've dreamed of all my life.
And it's for all sailing on the sea when wind and weapons fail.
Wisconsin Life, Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Well, that experience wasn't enough for Aubrey. He joins us in the studio now to tell us what he did next. Aubrey, hi.
Hi.
So Dennis Sullivan gave you a taste for the Great Lakes. What did you do next to pursue it?
Next, I looked at actually the upcoming festival and picked out what looked like the most awesome ship in the lineup, and that's the U.S. Brig Niagara, which is the flagship of Pennsylvania.
And you went on it for how long?
I did for 7 or 8 days, something like that.
And now, how many people are on it? How cramped did it feel?
Really cramped. It's a big ship in one sense. There's 40 people on board, and about 27 of those sleep in a room that's about 900 square feet. So it's sort of like having your English class move into your apartment.
All sleeping at the same time, or do you do that shift sleeping?
It's broken into shifts. So during the night, different people are awake and sleeping, but during the day, pretty much everybody is awake. So there's a lot of just a lot of folks around.
And I heard somebody saying, the person kind of giving you the tour of the ship, if you don't like cramped conditions, being in with lots of people, you're not going to be a good sailor. Did you think of yourself as a person who likes being in a crowd of people?
I was completely terrified before going. Uh-huh. I am not a I don't like crowds or tight spaces. I like lots of alone time.
So did you freak out? I mean, in this cramped conditions for a week?
No, it was actually I felt like a 10-year-old kid again. It was just you know, you get there and you have to be certified to do stuff. So they take you up into the mast and they show you your hammock and, you know, where, how to do all these drills and, you know, emergency stuff. And it's just adrenaline, I guess, took over.
What was it like going up in the mast? That would freak me out, I think.
It was a little scary the first time. You climb this webbed stuff called shrouds that take you up, and it's in stages. So the first time I just went up to the lower section, and it's sturdy, but it is shaky, and it's, you know, you have a harness, but you're not clipped in when you're climbing, and it's a long, I think that first platform is about 40 feet up, and it feels like a long way up there.
What's it like being with the same people in these cramped conditions for a week? Do you get on each other's nerves after a while?
You don't. There's not really it because of the situation. You're not conflicts don't generally happen because they just sort of can't, because it would be really bad for everything. So you just, it's like you can be sort of by yourself among. It's like being in New York or something. You know, I just go find a quiet spot on the bow. Maybe next to four other people, but I can read and.
And now this is a big team. What does it take? You know, it's not just like, well, I couldn't do a small sailboat either, but it's not just, I think I'm going to turn right or starboard. I adjust some levels and boom, I'm going. What does it take to turn a ship like this?
It takes a lot of people. At least 20, I believe. And that's. It's pretty amazing because the captain will give an order and then each division leader gives subsequent orders and then everybody goes to these all over the ship. And, you know, when you're doing maneuvers, it's really amazing to watch everybody work and very confusing for me.
What kind of skills did you pick up doing this?
Skills, you know, I don't know, like interpersonal relationships.
Oh, really?
Skills.
Okay.
I feel like I'm a much more, I'm not worried about crowds as much anymore. And I sort of feel like I can do anything. Like if I could do that, I can kind of do anything. But I mean, nothing I'm going to use in public radio a whole lot. I mean, unless, you know, we have some climbing involved here.
Yeah, and the transmitters and tying knots.
And
we need knots every
I did
now and
learn,
then.
I got an iPad app that has like all the knots I had to learn.
Just like before. The ancient sailors used.
Just like the, yeah. I actually got it from a treasure chest.
Nice.
In my yard.
So are you going to do something like this again?
I think I have to. I'm either going to go back to Niagara next summer, or there's ships on each coast. They're all over the place, all over the world. So I'm going to maybe do longer next time, take off a couple of weeks so I can actually learn what I'm doing.
So most of us probably will never do what you did and spend all this time on the ship. Can you give us a pep talk to go check out, I don't know, the tall ships in Green Bay this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, it is, if you're anywhere near there, I would say absolutely go do it. I mean, it is amazing to see them, let alone go on board. You know, you'll probably wait in line for a while, but it is completely worth it because they are just absolutely magical.
Aubrey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was WPR's own Aubrey Ralph talking about sailing the Great Lakes.
Coming up, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson joins us to talk about the federal budget and the talks of government shutdowns. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time. Some Republicans in Congress are talking about a temporary government shutdown to get a resolution passed to help stop funding for the Affordable Care Act.
The shutdown would come as part of budget negotiations for the next year, which need to wrap up by September 30th. But Senator Ron Johnson says a government shutdown is a bad idea.
Senator Johnson joins us now. Senator Johnson, welcome to the show.
Hello, Rob. Hello, Cynthia. How are you doing?
Really good. How are you today?
Just good.
Well, you are not wild about the idea of going to the brink of a government shutdown to shut down the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Why not?
Well, first of all, I don't like playing brinkmanship. Not with the American economy, not with people's lives and their livelihoods. So, you know, the fact of the matter is there really is not a real Armageddon government shutdown in anybody's future. So much of the budget, at least two-thirds, is mandatory spending. Whether the House passes a continuing resolution or not, most government is going to be funded anyway. So it's somewhat of a false threat to begin with. But you know, from my standpoint, every Republican is united behind wanting to repeal the health care law, defund it, dismantle the most damaging parts, basically doing anything we can to prevent the health care law from taking firm or permanent root. But unfortunately, with Senator Harry Reid in the Senate and President Obama in the White House, the only way you could actually defund it is basically repeal it, and that would require Senator Harry Reid to pass a bill through the Senate and President Obama to sign that same bill for that to happen. So it's also a threat that's actually impossible to, I think virtually impossible to follow on or carry out.
Some of your colleagues in Congress are saying that doing anything we can to change the Affordable Care Act includes bringing us to the brink of a government shutdown or a government spending slowdown of some sort. And there's been some public pressure from some people in the Tea Party movement saying, do it. How do you respond to them?
Well, first of all, there's nobody who's more dedicated to the repeal of Obamacare than myself. It is the reason I left a very good life here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, to run for the Senate to be the vote, you know, at least one of the votes to finally repeal Obamacare. So I am dedicated to doing everything I can to, like I said, prevent this law from taking firm or permanent root. But again, what I think we need to do, I think it's incumbent on Republicans, and I think it's going to be pretty obvious as the rolling train wreck that is the implementation of Obamacare, is it becomes revealed to the American public how damaging this thing is going to be to their health care. It's going to lower the quality of care. It's going to lead to rationing. I think we're already seeing medical innovation really limited because of the very harmful medical device tax. You know, we're not spending capital in the U.S. on new medical devices. We're shipping those jobs overseas. And oh, by the way, we just simply can't afford it. The health care law was sold as going to costing less than $1 trillion over 10 years. When it's fully implemented, it's going to cost $2.5 trillion. We've done some estimates, probably about $13 trillion over the next 30 years. We can't pay for the entitlements that we've already promised people. We certainly can't afford a new entitlement. So, again, there's been recent polling that shows 40 to 46% of Americans don't even realize the health care law is the law of the land because the president very cleverly delayed implementation of the health care law past his election, and now he's pushing the delay of some of the elements past the 2014 election. So Americans are simply unaware of the harmful effects. So it's really important for us to point out how harmful this is going to be, but also we should be talking about what we are actually for in terms of reforms of a health care system as we move forward as Republicans.
Well, are there parts of the Affordable Care Act that you do support? Supporters have been saying, hey, there are things out there that people are liking. Pre-existing conditions laws, allowing children, older children, 18 to 21, I think, in that neighborhood, to stay on their parents' health care. Do you want to get rid of the whole kit and caboodle, or are there parts you'd keep?
I think there may be elements. You know, for example, the allowing children to stay on their parents' policy up to the age of 26, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. That's actually been accomplished. The healthcare industry, adding those individuals to the parents' policy is incredibly low cost because young people are generally healthy. So that's already been accomplished. We can codify that if we had to. Certainly in terms of helping people with pre-existing conditions, America's a very compassionate society. We all want to see a strong social safety net. There are ways of dealing with that without having a government takeover of the entire health care system or basically national control over all of our health care. You know, in the state of Wisconsin, we have very good care at, you know, relative to costs around the nation at a relatively more reasonable cost. And we had, I think, 95% of all Wisconsinites was covered by insurance. We did not need a national health care law that will basically dictate what we have to do here in Wisconsin. That is a train wreck in implementation, which is, again, understand, President Obama is basically acknowledging what a train wreck it will be by delaying the employer mandate, delaying the income verification, the verification of the qualifications for people that are going to be subsidized by this, as well as he's delaying the the overall caps in terms of out-of-pocket, the minimum. So there's so many things that this administration is basically admitting almost 3.5 years after passage that they can't implement. You've got 20,000 pages of additional regulations. That thing stands, that stack of paper stands almost 7 feet tall. This is a mess. It's going to be a disaster for our healthcare system, our budget, and Americans just have to come to realize that and hopefully create the political pressure to really get the political class in Washington to finally repeal it.
Is national takeover an exaggeration? Most of the insurance that people get is still going to be through private companies of one sort or another.
I think a number of Democrats have certainly admitted that this was their grand strategy. Pass Obamacare, realizing how unwieldy it was going to be, what a disaster it was going to be, hoping then the next step would be, the public cry as our healthcare system starts collapsing for the government to come in there and just take over the entire healthcare system. So, no, I think it was actually designed to lead directly to a single-payer system, because part of the problem with these changes is you take a look at what is going to happen to the individual insurance rates for young, healthy people. Those rates are going to skyrocket as young, healthy people are asked to subsidize the people who are older and less healthy. And as a result, the penalties are set so low, the young won't participate in the exchanges, so everybody's insurance rates will probably skyrocket. And again, then the administration will be blaming the healthcare companies for skyrocketing costs leading to a government takeover. So, yeah, it's not designed as a single-payer system, it's on paper, but I think it eventually leads to that.
You mentioned earlier that Republicans need to offer their own solutions to the healthcare system in the United States. What kind of things would you look for?
Well, first of all, I think you need to increase competition in the healthcare market. Part of the problem we have in healthcare is that we have pretty well removed the consumer from directly paying for so many of the services that they probably could, where you'd actually have price mechanisms in place. You could have the discipline of a competitive system containing costs. That's what happens in every other area of marketable services. The competitive system works. We need to reintroduce competition. We need to, rather than basically eliminate HSAs or severely limit them, we should expand HSAs, which are health savings accounts. That's putting money in people's pockets to spend directly on health care, not rely on a third-party payer system. We should allow individuals to purchase health care across state lines. That would allow individuals to say, if for example, Wisconsin has too many mandates driving up the cost of their health care, and they don't need all of those things attached to their health insurance policy, they go to another state that mandates less coverage and purchase an insurance policy, probably a dramatically lower cost. So what you need to do is reinstitute competition in the free market competitive system into healthcare. And just an example in terms of how that would work. Eye care is generally not covered by insurance. It's a form of healthcare. It's part of a market system that the business world has created, businesses that you can walk off the street, get eyeglasses without an appointment in an hour, two for the price of one. And people need to take a look at the cost of laser surgeries actually declined over the last 10 years while the quality has dramatically increased. So we just have to bring more of our market-based competitive system back into healthcare with those price mechanisms. That's the way you contain costs without rationing care.
One of the criticisms of the competitive market system, such as it was before Obamacare, was that it gave an incentive to either cherry-pick the healthiest customers and not take the expensive ones, or for companies to look for ways to, insurance companies to deny making payments, to deny claims, and in some cases, unjustly, a lot of people argued.
Again, you're talking about a third-party payer system. Today, only 12 cents of every healthcare dollar is actually paid directly from the patient to the healthcare provider. Well, the beauty about HSAs, those were coupled with high deductible plans. What insurance should really be? Insurance should cover the extraordinary expense, the emergency things, the big procedures. Whereas if you've got a child with an ear infection, you ought to be able to go into for example, and by the way, this is exactly how the marketplace responded with HSAs. Walgreens, Walmart, CVS developed walk-in clinics staffed by nurse practitioners to see a child with an ear infection for $35 versus the emergency room using a third-party payer system that might cost $200 or $250 for that same visit. So again, what we need to do is we need to rely on individuals making those wise consumer choices with money out of their own pockets and buy health insurance that is a high deductible plan reserved for the larger expenditures and the emergency treatments.
Senator Johnson, just 30 seconds. Do you see a future that sees no more Affordable Care Act?
Boy, I sure hope so, because I just cannot emphasize really what a disaster the health care law will be for our health care system and for our budget. We simply can't afford this, and we can't afford the damage it will do to not a perfect health care system, but still, I think, the finest health care system in the world.
Senator Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
You guys have a great day. Thanks.
That was Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. We'll keep covering that health care implementation as it proceeds.
Coming up, we'll talk to a guest from a human rights organization about the Pentagon's new guidelines for sexual assault. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. In just a bit, we'll look at a new effort to preserve the sounds of the United States, early recordings of speeches, music, and more. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
First, the Pentagon announced a plan today to deal with sexual assaults in the military, including tighter controls on recruiters and trainers, plus stronger protections for victims.
The Pentagon also aims to improve tracking of complaints and cases against sexual abuse. Joining us now is Taryn Meeks, Executive Director of Protect Our Defenders, a human rights organization supporting victims of military sexual assault. Taryn, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, your organization says the Pentagon's changes proposed today still fall short of true reform. Can you explain why?
They do. The Pentagon announced a number of changes to the military justice system, and we do support the efforts that attack the status quo. But these changes are mostly just tweaks to a broken system. So there's one exception. With one exception, these changes do not constitute fundamental reform, and they're not sufficient to address the crisis.
There's one way in that they're not?
Well, there's one exception where it does create what we refer to as a special victims council or legal representation. This is an important step in the right direction. It's something that we have been advocating for quite some time. And we've even filed an amicus brief to support the Air Force's Special Victims Council program. The Air Force was the only branch to have something like this. So this is something that the Pentagon has issued a mandate now that all branches provide an attorney, a lawyer, to victims of sexual assault through the process. But that's only one of the multiple provisions that they announced today. The rest are just tweaking with the margins. They don't create the fundamental reform that's necessary to create a just system and to provide justice for victims. Mm.
Well, let's take a step back for a little bit and tell us, how big of a problem is sexual assault in the military?
Well, unfortunately, it is a big problem. It's a problem that we've seen for decades. It's a problem that's nothing new, and the military has failed, unfortunately, time and again with each new scandal, with each new opportunity for change to create fundamental reform that's going to restructure the system, because that's really what we have to have.
What's been the reaction from military leaders, though, in the light of all this controversy and this opportunity for change?
The military has resisted change. Historically resisted change, and really only when pushed externally, so pushed by public pressure, pushed by the media, pushed by policymakers, do they come forward with their own version of change, which is what we're seeing today. So the military has created several points of change today, but substantively they don't do much of anything. And so that's, I think, a reaction to the public pressure.
So under the Pentagon's plan announced today, each service needs to establish a victim advocacy program to provide legal advice and representation for those who are filing complaints of sexual assault. So in your mind, what would the ideal victim advocacy program look like?
Well, it would have representation, which is what the Pentagon has gone forward and implemented today. And that's in part because the Air Force took the initiative to have this representation, to have this legal counsel be able to stand by the victim's side throughout the entire process and advocate for the victim through the court-martial process, represent the victim in and out of court. And so the Air Force has had such a success with that program. We've heard that they have seen over 400 victims through the program and have an extremely high success rate. Victims are seeing the process through. They're not dropping out because they have someone there who supports them, who legally represents them. And so this is a program we've been advocating for quite some time. It's key to ensuring that victims who are in the process are properly protected. But that's just victims who are in the process. Victims, unfortunately, don't trust the system, and rightly so. They don't trust the fact that the chain of command, that commanders have the sole discretion to determine whether a case goes to court-martial at all. And so victims aren't reporting. We really have to address the fact that sexual assault is a huge problem. Victims don't trust the system, and we really need to start at the ground level, at that foundation, at removing the decision-making process from the chain of command and giving that to independent military prosecutors.
So talk a little bit about that more specifically. How can the culture of the military be changed a bit to perhaps encourage trust on an individual level?
Well, you have to start with the trust of the system, too. So there are educational campaigns, of course, that can help on an individual level. We need to re-educate the troops. We need to teach them respect for one another. We need to teach them that sexual assault is a crime and what predators are really like. And we need to re-educate our commanders as well about victims and victims' rights and about the way that victims handle sexual assault. But you have to trust the system, because even if you have an individual who trusts their mentor, who trusts the next person in the chain of command, who trusts their fellow soldier, sailor, airman, or marine, they have to trust the system in order to report a crime.
Okay, so talk a little bit about the system and what is discouraging to a victim about it.
Well, there are many points of discouragement, unfortunately. I mean, many points of failure along the system. And again, what you have to start with is removing that power, that decision-making process from the accused commander. As it stands now, when a victim reports a sexual assault, it's the accused, the defendant's commander, the person, the perpetrator's commander, who makes that sole decision on whether or not that case should go to trial, whether it should be disposed of in an alternate disposition, whether nothing should happen. That person decides the basis of the case, and if they're accused, if that perpetrator is a good soldier, sailor, airman, or marine, then that commander has the ability and the discretion to do nothing, to take no action. And historically, we've seen that happen. And so that's the start. There are other points along the way throughout the court-martial process that are problematic, that are traumatic, that are unjust, all the way through sentencing, where we've seen just abysmally low sentences for offenders. And it's really a slap in the face to victims, people who've been assaulted and had a jury convict, but then award very paltry sentences, sometimes just weeks in confinement, sometimes no discharge, allowing that offender to return to the unit. That's the slap in the face. That's the message they're sending to the victim, that they don't matter. And all the way through the clemency process, which we've seen recently, unfortunately, commanders have unfettered discretion to overturn sentences, to overturn convictions, which we saw in Aviano with Lieutenant General Franklin and Lieutenant Colonel Wilkerson's case. So this, there are many points of failures, and they all must be addressed for victims to have a shot at justice.
It sounds like a very complex issue. Is the system actually fixable in your mind?
It is. It definitely is. I actually served in the Navy. I'm a former judge advocate myself. I believe in the system. I believe in the military. I believe in our servicemen and women. It can be fixed. It can be made better. And it can be the system that our service members deserve.
So do victims face a backlash when they report these crimes?
Unfortunately, yes. Many victims don't report because they're afraid nothing will happen or they're afraid of being retaliated against. And there are, unfortunately, many ways of being retaliated against. We often see victims who face themselves collateral misconduct charges and various other means of retaliation. And so, unfortunately, it's a deterrent because they are afraid, again, of the system. And that's really what we have to correct, both systematically, procedurally, and through education.
Sexual assault isn't a problem isolated just to the military. It's certainly a societal problem as well. Do you think we need to change the way that society looks at sexual violence?
Of course. Of course. I think that there certainly are a lot of running themes between the two. Luckily, the military is a closed universe, so I think that we have an opportunity to really eradicate sexual assault, to address it in ways that are more challenging with society as a whole.
So if someone is a victim of military sexual abuse, what resources are already out there for them?
Well, first and foremost, if they're in a crisis, they should turn immediately to emergency services. So if they're in a crisis, they should get themselves to a safe place and contact emergency personnel. There are also many services that are available through our website, protectourdefenders.com. We have created local service networks so that we can put survivors, victims of sexual assault, in touch with people who can help them in their communities. There are peer-to-peer support services, and we recently launched a pro bono network, which allows victims to have legal services free of service to them.
Well, Taryn, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Taryn Meeks is Executive Director of Protect Our Defenders.
Coming up next, we'll look at a new effort to preserve early recordings of speeches, music, and much more. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book on how people deal with losing the place they call home.
First, in an effort to preserve the sounds of America, in a joint project with the Library of Congress, our next guest's group is working to find recordings of music, speeches, and more, and keep them around for future generations.
They've been in the news lately after a big donation from musician Jack White of the White Stripes. Gerald Seligman joins us now. He's Executive Director of the National Recording Preservation Foundation. Gerald, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for your interest.
One of the first things that leaps to mind when we're talking about preserving recordings is music. What kind of musical recordings are you looking to find and preserve?
Well, I think the important thing is not to be a curator, but rather to try to create an infrastructure and help fund preservation recordings of all kinds, traditional and popular and classical, and really not to be the selector, but the supporter.
And what kind of things are you looking for exactly?
Well, many people assume, because so much is available these days on streaming services, on iTunes and all the rest, and then, of course, in vinyl and CDs, there's an assumption that a lot of the music in America's kind of the treasures of the past are pretty much all available. The reality is that maybe 16% of it is actually released. And the rest of it, and even a lot of the great treasures, are in vaults, they're in archives, sometimes they're not protected at all. And all of these things are recorded on very fragile media, so some of them are deteriorating, some are even past recuperation, and others just need good attention, good conditions.
And what, you mentioned some of the fragile materials that they're on. What kind of things are we talking about?
You know, we're talking about the entire history of recorded sound. And, of course, we're interested in music, but as you mentioned in the lead-in, also famous speeches and old broadcasts and interviews and spoken word, really anything of any kind that has ever been recorded on audio media. So the media themselves, you know, start with the old cylinders of Edison and go on to 78s and acetates and tapes and DATs and VHS and U-matic. There have been so many different media used, and a lot of these, it's even hard to find the machines to play them back and digitize them. But the media themselves are in a lot of cases degrading.
And I'm looking over at our old reel-to-reel machine that's in our studio now, and I'm not sure why. I don't know what the last time it was used, but there's got to be a lot of great stuff at, I don't know, radio stations, university archives around the country sitting on a reel-to-reel. How long do we have to save something like that?
You know, it really depends on the conditions of the storage and the medium itself, because, you know, when the Film Foundation started looking into old silent films, because that was on a real perishable, it was on a nitrite-based medium, they discovered that 80% of the silent films had turned to dust. Mm-hmm. Now, with audio, it's not as bad, but there were some where kind of the recording layer just kind of peeled off into these little shards and you know, at the bottom of these cases. So, you know, there's no kind of set time limit on these things, and that's why they have to be looked at, and they have to be recuperated where necessary.
So on what medium are you preserving? Are you just preserving the actual, 78s?
Yeah.
Or are you recording them digitally into a database, or where are they going?
You know, all over the country there are many archives. A lot of them are with libraries and universities and other institutions in the Library of Congress. And these are the people who are actually doing the preservation work. And then, of course, the commercial companies like record labels, like a lot of the radio broadcasters, they also are looking over, for better and for worse, you know, some do better jobs than others, their own archives. So what we're trying to do is not do the recuperation ourselves, but help locate all of this stuff and then offer grants to fix a lot of it and to digitize. You ask what media we're going to put them on.
Mm-hmm.
The best medium at this point is digital because it's just zeros and ones, and that doesn't degrade. All you have to do is just keep updating it to whatever storage mechanism, the hard drives, or those systems. But digitizing is the key, and then trying to keep the originals, of course.
I guess a big question here is why? What do we lose if we don't have this audio heritage available to us?
Think about it. Think about what we have, the treasures in our nation's history. Some things are very obscure, some things aren't. Think about, you know, jazz was born, for example, in New Orleans, and it moved up the Mississippi River to Chicago and over to New York and all around. I mean, the whole history of recorded jazz is on recordable media. Or think of the great speeches. I mean, we're coming up to the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March on Washington, you know, Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech and all the speeches that were made from that famous day were all on recorded media. So we need to preserve these things because, you know, 50 years later, we're moved by this material, and it's really important for our history and our sense of ourselves. And so we have to make sure it's going to be around for another 50 years and 50 past that.
So I'm curious how you will ensure that the new medium will prevail and that they won't be lost in another way in the future.
Well, the idea is always to be upgrading. Unfortunately, it's sort of an endless process. And if you think of, let's take some of these early jazz recordings that I just mentioned. You know, some of them were recorded on 78s, and then they were transferred onto vinyl. And then when CDs came around, they were on, you know, CDs where they were on 8-track tapes or cassette tapes. And now they're on streaming on digital media. So each time, the material, the source, the music has remained the same, but it has been upgraded to whatever the latest media was. And you'd have to do that with digital as well. The thing is that the digital doesn't degrade. Because it is mm-hmm. digital. It's numerical significance is zeros and ones. So overall, the idea is just to make sure that the media you've got it in, the hard drive, the cloud drives, whatever they are, that those are, you know, always maintained and always updated with better technologies.
You mentioned New Orleans and the birthplace of jazz and source of so much music. I think one of the areas I've heard you mention in other interviews is the impact of Hurricane Katrina and trying to find recordings threatened, damaged in that.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably why I was just coming to the New Orleans example now with jazz, is because it's very much on the mind of many of us who care about the cultural heritage of that region and that miracle of a city when it comes to American culture. So many of the tapes and the archives were underwater for 1 and 2 weeks. And, for example, Alan Toussaint, one of the great kind of patrons of New Orleans, I just saw him at a concert here in New York over the weekend, and his tape vault was underwater for 2 weeks. Uh-huh. A lot of it was damaged. His son told me some of it beyond repair, but some of it can be repaired. So what we want to do is get in as a very early project, and try to get the right people around the table and then maybe work with some students and some others to just, you know, do a tally of what's damaged, what can be fixed, what can't be fixed, what needs emergency attention, and then offer grants. We'll do fundraising and then hand the grants over to the people doing the work so that we can maintain this. So that's a different kind of, you know, preservation work, because that's due to catastrophe
mm-hmm.
and not what we were saying earlier, which is just the normal degradation over time.
So you're doing this work, bringing together public and private money to support people who are finding these recordings and preserving them. You're working with Library of Congress. I assume there are all these, in a way, treasure hunters out there trying to find these troves of audio. What does it feel like when you hear about something that we had no idea existed from 100 years ago?
You know, it's a wonderful process of discovery. And by the way, we ourselves, we're actually independent of Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. We were created by an act of Congress, but we were created to be independent and to collaborate, but to be able to set our own priorities according to the board and all of that. And you mentioned Jack White. He's on the board. T-Bone Burnett's on the board. A lot of engineers, industry types. I'm sorry, can you just repeat that question?
Yeah, just the feeling like when you hear a success story, I guess.
Right. You know, it's very hard. You can imagine that with my position, I'm doing constant internet searches to try to find archives and just try to find information, and partly just for my own entertainment, because so much is streaming these days, and also for research for possible projects. And it's actually hard to find because there's no one database. Nobody knows what's out there to a sufficient degree. Many of the archives in universities and private collections, and I mean private, you know, like record companies, broadcasting companies, you can find out what they've got. But there is so much out there that has kind of is temporarily lost. And we don't know if it's been destroyed and lost forever, or it's a box in somebody's attic somewhere, you know, because their father or grandfather had a radio station, or their uncle loved recording live music off the radio and has an archive that nobody else has because the rest has been lost. There is so much of that out there, and what we've got to do is figure out where it is, how to find it, and make it accessible. So there are these incredible discoveries occasionally where, and sometimes it's anecdotal. I was speaking to somebody from the BBC, and he was saying that he was doing a research project, and he came across tapes of former slaves who were interviewed at the end of their lives about their lives, being born into slavery, about Reconstruction in the years afterwards, and their paths towards, you know, full rights and citizenship. And tapes of this exist. So there are some pretty remarkable, thrilling things. What we've got to figure out is, how do we locate it, mm-hmm. you know? How do we preserve it, raise the money to recuperate all of this stuff? And most importantly, because it's a real important part of our mandate, how to make it accessible to the general public, not just scholars.
Well, Gerald, we only have a few seconds left. Could you tell us, if someone wanted to donate some sound to you, how would they? Where can they go to find more information?
Well, we're just getting up and running, thanks in part to that donation of Jack White. We have a website, recordingpreservation.org, which we're going to be updating tremendously. So one of the things you can do there is actually donate to our effort, because we're going to be raising funds to give out for these projects. And I would say within about 3 months, we're going to start having on the site places where people could say, I have the following collection. Is this of interest? Does this have values? Because what we want to do is link up those queries with the collectors, with the universities, with the archives.
Great. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Gerald. That was Gerald Seligman. He's executive director of the National Recording Preservation Foundation. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.